I'm John Aran, Puck's sports correspondent, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity, where I will take you inside the executive suites and owner's boxes that run the entire sports business. Twice a week, I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media and give you a window into the inside conversations that are happening throughout sports media. So be sure to follow and listen to The Varsity Podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
On Twitter, at Rich Cioli. Our big story of the hour brought to you by our buddy, Dr. Mike Vanaria, VanariaDental.com. Go see him today for your perfect smile, V-A-N-A-R-I-A, VanariaDental.com. There's 21 of them. I'll quickly go through a couple of the Very Fine People hoax, the Project 2025 hoax, false claims on the Trump trade deficit, which is also another thing that she lied about. Putin can do whatever the hell he wants. It's another debunk thing. Dictator on day one, debunked. Blaming botched Afghanistan withdrawal and Trump, which she did. She blamed Trump for meeting with the Taliban, which I thought, by the way, that annoyed me last night. I mean, isn't the goal of a president to negotiate peace? I'm not saying you have to leave all her stuff there and do and withdraw with such disaster, but didn't we want to wind down the war on terror at some point? So now it's a bad thing if he's meeting with the Taliban? Like he did it at Camp David? I don't understand. I mean, if he met him in the Oval Office, would that have been better? If he met him at Starbucks? You're trying to wind down the war on terror. I didn't understand that attack point by her last night, other than the Democrats are just a party of war. The bloodbath hoax, the abortion monitor hoax, that there be like a monitor on women or something like that. And there's a whole, I mean, there's a lot of them. Suckers and losers, that she threw that out. There's a whole bunch of different, there were 21 in total. And of course, nobody checked her on that, including when she lied and said that she wouldn't take the guns away because she is a, and thank you, Matt. And her administration is actively negotiating with Hamas to end, you know, to try to get a ceasefire with Israel right now. But somehow that's okay, but negotiating with the Taliban isn't. And I mean, just to push it, she's going on about, oh, it's sacred Camp David, and you have the Taliban there. It's like, but we're trying to end the war. I mean, that's the point here. You're trying to end the war. Why is it that you don't like ending war, other than the fact that Bobby Kennedy's correct? You're just the freaking party of war. I mean, I don't know what else to tell you. You know what I mean? So let me share this with you. This is an undecided voter, an independent voter. Kamala did not make an effort to defend the administration's immigration policies at all. This was on Fox News. Take a listen.
I thought it was interesting when asked directly by the moderators, Kamala, the vice president, didn't even make an effort to defend the administration's immigration policies at all. She can't. It's indefensible. So she pivoted and she deflected, and I thought successfully. But they totally rewrote all of Trump's immigration policies year one, first 100 days. I would have liked to have seen an explanation for the country as to why they did that. I thought it was interesting when...
So at some point, we got to turn our attention to the vice presidential debate. That'll be here before you know it. I do want to get into the whole issue of these undecided voters. This New York Times article is pretty amazing. I also have a thing on Tim Walz and his definition of freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is coming under attack. And this administration is weaponized everything. The Department of Justice completely weaponized. I thought that was a good line by Trump last night when he talked about the weaponization of the Department of Justice and that he did that. But Tim Walz is scary. You got to understand this guy. There's a Minnesota law that muzzles employers, and it's now getting a legal challenge. I'll get into that probably on tomorrow's show with you, but it's an excellent, excellent story that I want to at some point talk about. Let's do this here. I'll take a quick call. Doug is in Pensauken. Doug, what'd you think of the debate?
Hey, that was a total rig job. Trump could have stood there and said, water is wet, and they would challenge him on it.
Yeah.
It's just absolutely insane. I just wish that Trump should have hammered this point probably also, that he should have said he's the only recent president to set foot in North Korea. Like, think about how massive that was. Like, Trump, when Trump challenged Kim Jong-un, that Twitter war, or whatever that you want to call that, he didn't back down. He stood his ground, and he threw strength. Kim Jong-un respected that and invited him to North Korea. And, you know, we were on the verge of a peace with North Korea, of all places, at the time, you know? That should have definitely been brought up.
Yeah, it's not a bad thing to try to negotiate peace. I remember when they had that false missile alert and they thought North Korea had attacked Hawaii, and my, you know, lefty brother-in-law was all angry at me. I mean, don't you want to negotiate peace so you don't have to worry about nuclear strikes?
See, this is the problem with the left. They have no morals. They are like sails. Whichever way the wind shifts, that's the direction they go. Whatever the most popular Twitter.
I think I lost you, Doug. Doug, I lost you, but thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Anthony's in Cape May. We'll be back October 11th for our next live show. Anthony, hope to see you at the Grand Hotel. What's going on?
Hey, what's up, brother? How you been?
I'm good, man. What are your thoughts on the debate?
Well, listen, I think that they should Trump should definitely take on Kamala without a problem. But the issue is you don't have to bow to them. I find it very upsetting that the
Anthony's breaking up here big time. I'm sorry, Anthony, you're breaking up. Let me play this quick clip for you. This is Trump last night talking about the weaponization of the Department of Justice. I thought this was a great point he made last night. Cut number 5.
Excuse me. Every one of those cases was started by them against their political opponent. And I'm winning most of them, and I will win the rest on appeal. And you saw that with the decision that came down just recently from the Supreme Court. I'm winning most of them. But those are cases. It's called weaponization. Never happened in this country. They weaponized the Justice Department. Every one of those cases was involved with the DOJ, from Atlanta and Fannie Willis to the Attorney General of New York and the DA in New York, every one of those cases. And then they say, oh, he's a criminal. They're the ones that made them go after me. By the way, Joe Biden was found essentially guilty on the documents case. And what happened in my documents case? They said, oh, that's the toughest of them all. A complete and total victory. 2 months ago, it was thrown out. It's weaponization, and they used it, and it's never happened in this country. They used it to try and win an election. They're fake cases.
There's another thing, too, that I would have done if I were him last night. I would have gone after the unrealized capital gains thing, and I would have made that a huge part of the show, because the sell-off that would be caused by a levy on unrealized capital gains would devastate 401ks. It would devastate it. And he could use that as an attack point and say, she wants to go after unrealized capital gains, and that's going to destroy your retirement. You're never going to be able to retire. Every 401k in this country is going to suffer. You'll be working for the rest of your life. I would hammer that. The unrealized capital gains. Absolutely, I would do that. And I would brag if I were him about the fact that they lowered the corporate tax rate and brought all this money in from overseas and got it back into the United States of America. I mean, there were some real opportunities for some kill shots last night, and I want to see those kill shots. I want to see those shots taken by him and just put her out of her misery. You know what I mean? And just do that. But you got to plan for that. You got to go in there thinking in terms of what you're going to say and then plan on hitting her on these things, because they are sitting around the table and they're deciding what kind of attacks they're going to levy on Trump. And you can't let them get under your skin. You know, that's part of the problem. Top 5 lies that the ABC News moderators last night refused to fact check or falsely fact check during the debate. Mandatory firearm buybacks. They said nothing. The Very Fine People hoax. Post-birth abortion. There are 6 states that do not have a limit on that in this country, on when you can have an abortion. Defunding the police, and the bloodbath hoax, which, of course, Trump was talking about the auto industry, and he was literally quoting a letter from a Chinese EV manufacturer when he said the issue of the bloodbath. Those hoaxes, those 5 hoaxes, were not checked by this administration, by the moderators last night during the debate. So there you go. Taylor Swift, yep, she endorsed. I don't think we mentioned it, but yes. What did you want to note, Matt DeSantis?
Oh, I just wanted to note that people are making it seem as this is a massive deal, and now Kamala Harris is definitely going to win. But she endorsed Phil Bredesen for U.S. Senate in Tennessee in 2018, and Marsha Blackburn beat him by over 10 points.
So the guy Taylor Swift backed beat Marsha Blackburn by 10 points. That's the power of Taylor Swift.
The opposite. Marsha Blackburn beat Bredesen by 10-plus points.
Taylor Swift's endorsement caused Marsha Blackburn to beat the guy Taylor Swift endorsed by 10 points.
Yes.
Exactly. Marsha Blackburn's the senator from Tennessee?
Yes, and not
I don't think that's right.
Bredesen,
I think you're wrong on that. I think you should fact check that. The other guy won.
Pretty sure.
Swift backed him. He definitely won.
I'm pretty sure Marsha Blackburn is in the Senate, and Bredesen is not.
I don't think that's true. Who is the senator from Tennessee? Let's see. You're going to say Phil something or other. Phil Hagerty and Marsha Blackburn. Oh, okay. All right. I stand corrected. Fine. What are you going to do? Can't get everything right. All right. I mean, there's 100 of them. How am I going to know all of them? I mean, come on. It's ridiculous. All right. We got a lot more to talk about as the show goes on today. I do want to say NJ Diet's going to help you lose some weight. Are you ready? You got to be ready. Come on. Let's do this. What are you waiting for? You put on summer weight. I get it. A lot of barbecues, cheeseburgers, beers, margaritas by the pool. And now you're thinking, I want to get in shape. Well, do it. Just call NJ Diet, 855-5-NJ-DIET. And don't do the shots. Don't do that stuff. They're banned in European countries right now.
I'm John Oran, Puck's sports correspondent. And I have a new podcast called The Varsity, where I will take you inside the executive suites and owner's boxes that run the entire sports business. Twice a week, I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media and give you a window into the inside conversations that are happening throughout sports media. So be sure to follow and listen to The Varsity Podcast, available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot of them. There's all kinds of side effects. NJ Diet's all natural. No shots, no surgery, none of that stuff. It's the real deal, and it works, and it's guaranteed weight loss. You will lose, not can lose, you will lose 20 to 40 plus pounds in only 40 days, contractually guaranteed. And you're going to get the doctor's personal email and phone number. They're going to be with you the entire way. Dr. T is going to take great care of you. What are you waiting for? You know you want to do this. Get started now. NJDiet.com. 40 days goes by like that, and then you're 20 to 40 pounds lighter, feeling better, looking better too. 855-5-NJ-DIET. 855-5-NJ-DIET. NJDiet.com, and lose the weight for good.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
So who really won the debate last night? Well, if you're a pundit, you said Kamala Harris. But if you're an undecided voter, not so sure. This is from the far right wing New York Times. So take it with a grain of salt. Welcome back to the show. Glad you're here. 855-839-1210 on Twitter at Rich Zeoli. The far right wing New York Times. And obviously I say that in jest. By the way, considering it is 9/11 today. You know, and there's another story I have today, and I mentioned this earlier in the show about the 9/11 heroes. You know, we have lost more first responders from 9/11 related causes than we have from 9/11. And that was an amazing statistic that I heard. And so many of them today in this day and age are still dealing with so much regarding the health and the cancers and all the other issues because Christy Todd Whitless told everybody the air was fine. They said the air was fine back then. And my father's one of those people, you know, who struggles with that. My dad has 9/11 related illnesses. My dad, in fact, they just lost another one of their guys yesterday, as a matter of fact. So it's really tough. And there's no doubt that I don't want to forget, as we continue, all these men and women who were down there at 9/11 and the pit and everything else and how they're still dealing with this and all the health issues, suffering with cancer. So we're going to talk to – there's an interview I do. I recorded an interview with my dad a couple years ago. We play it every 9/11. I'm going to do it again today to close the show. But I just wanted to mention to you that nearly 17,000 first responders are suffering cancers and diseases linked to 9/11 over two decades later. More than 45,000 people are living with the physical manifestations of the September 11th attacks more than two decades after the tragedy. At least 45,200 civilians and officers from the FDNY, NYPD, and Port Authority of New York and New Jersey are suffering from at least one cancer or disease that has been directly linked to the largest terrorist attack in history. By the way, way worse than January 6th. Way worse than January 6th. I thought that was so shameful last night when Kamala Harris said it was the worst attack in our country since the Civil War. She said that on September 10th. The whopping total is 1,408% greater than the death toll for the tragedy itself. 2,997 victims were killed in the Twin Tower collapse and aftermath. The shocking number reflects the amount of victims enrolled in the World Trade Center health program with verified illnesses. Because the project only recognizes some cancers and diseases, officials warn the true total of six survivors is much higher. And I don't want anyone to forget that. It's very, very important. So, coming back to this story from the far-right-wing New York Times, voters said the vice president talked about a sweeping vision to fix the country's most stubborn problems, but they wanted the fine print. This is written by Jeremy Peters, Jack Healy, and Campbell Robertson. For weeks, undecided voters have been asking for more substance. You know what? Let me just say what, in my opinion, to define what an undecided voter is. I'll tell you what I think it is, because I know people say that there's not many left out there. Here's what I think it is. I think there are people out there that don't like Donald Trump. They know deep down inside he's better. They just don't like him. It's just as simple as that. I think it really is. Occam's razor. It's the simplest explanation. I'm not one of those people, obviously. Yeah, I like the guy. I'm fond of the guy. And I personally think that we had a much better debate prep team when I was involved. I'm just going to leave it at that. But I think there's a number of people out there who don't like him. They just don't. And they know deep down inside he's better. But they want an excuse to vote against him. That really is what it is. And so they're looking for any reason that they can to justify their vote because they know it goes against their own self-interest. People are primarily very self-interested. And I don't mean that as a bad thing. It's just the reality of life. So voters are always thinking about what's in it for me and what's best for me and my family. There's no way you can tell me that you're better off under this administration than you were under Trump. You can't. Nobody can say that. But there are people, they know that they were better off under Trump, but they just don't like him. They find him to be rude and brash and whatever else. And they don't like the guy and they don't like what happened on January 6th, for example, whatever it is. And so they want to vote for somebody else. But they also realize that Kamala Harris is a huge progressive lunatic, and she's going to bring on progressive lunatic policies. And so they're trying to find a way that they can make these two things fit. That's what I think undecided voters are. That's who I think they are. I can't qualify that with anything. I don't have any real data points on that. It's what my gut tells me. Just what my gut tells me, just from observations. I know that I gab on for 4 hours a day, 5 days a week. Fridays are questionable, but I do a lot of listening. You know, when I'm not on the air, I tend to listen a whole lot more than I talk. It's one of the things I learned very early on in talk radio. As I was getting into this, I was filling in on WABC in New York. I had no business being on the radio back then. I didn't know what I was doing. But Lori Cantillo, who was the program director, said you should go to bars and restaurants and just observe and listen to what people are saying. And I always took that advice to heart. So when I'm hanging out with people and they ask me my opinion on politics, I always say, hey, listen, I talk about it all day. I want to hear what you have to think, what you have to say. And I do that for a reason. I like to hear what people have to say. And this may shock you. I have a lot of friends across all kinds of different political ideas. I'm just that kind of a guy. I'm not going to lose a friendship because I disagree with somebody politically. I have a great friend of mine. We've been friends forever. We've been in the fight, the political fight forever. He just can't stand Donald Trump. And I know deep down inside he's going to vote for him, but he can't stand him. He just can't stand him. If it were another Republican, it wouldn't even be a question for him, but he just doesn't like Trump personally. But he also makes a lot of money, and I know that he doesn't want to see his money taken from him and then redistributed to other people who just don't want to work. I know that. But he's a great example of that. I think he's one of those people. He deep down knows Trump's better. He doesn't want to vote for him because he doesn't like him. But he's very reluctant about Kamala Harris. I think at the end of the day, he votes for Trump. I think at the end of the day, these undecided voters vote for Trump. I still think Trump wins. Did he have a chance last night to put the knockout punch in? Yeah, damn right he did. And he didn't take it. And that's why I'm not happy. But hopefully there'll be another debate, and hopefully he'll have the chance to do that again. Go on offense and just pummel her. Because when you go down the road of pushing back on her economic policies, you win. Bottom line. So this New York Times article, they talk, Bob and Sharon Reed, 77-year-old retired teachers who live on a farm in central PA, had high hopes for the debate between Harris and former President Donald Trump. They thought that they would come away with a candidate to support in November, but Ms. Reed said it was all disappointing. The couple ended the night wondering how the costly programs each candidate supported, Mr. Trump's tariffs, and Ms. Harris's aid to young families and small businesses would help a couple like them living on a fixed income that has not kept pace with inflation. They said they didn't hear detailed answers on immigration or foreign policy either. Tuesday night was the first time any voter had seen Mr. Trump and Ms. Harris together. The two candidates had never met in person before, creating considerable trepidation among supporters. Excuse me. Of both campaigns about how they might perform. Immediate reaction from political analysts favored Ms. Harris, who attacks appeared to rattle Mr. Trump. She goaded him over the various criminal blah, 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 blah. But not all voters, especially those undecided few who could sway the election, were effusive about the vice president's performance. In interviews, those undecided voters acknowledged that Ms. Harris seemed more presidential than Mr. Trump, and they said she laid out a sweeping vision to fix some of the country's most stubborn problems. But they also said she did not seem much different from Mr. Biden, and they wanted change. And most of all, what they wanted to hear and didn't was the fine print. Voters said they were glad she has a tax and economic plan, but they want to know how it will become law when Washington is so polarized. They know she wants to give assistance to first-time homebuyers, but doubted that it was realistic. The woman in the article said she tried a couple times to say, I want to do this, I want to do that, and that's nice promises. I hope she can get them through Congress. But she was very skeptical. And it goes on to say that this other person here, Shavanka Kelly, who lives in Milwaukee, said her three teenage daughters began laughing when Mr. Trump ranted about false social media rumors that migrants in Ohio are stealing and eating pets. It was kind of like, can you take him serious, she said. She liked a lot of what Vice President Harris had to say. But she didn't kind of separate herself from Joe Biden, adding that she was still on the fence. Still on the fence. Ms. Harris, who remains unfamiliar to many Americans, is working under an extreme time crunch to persuade voters that she is presidential material. The euphoric scenes from the summer of Democrats celebrating her entry into the race did not reflect the reality in many American homes. 28% of likely voters said in the latest Time Siena poll that they felt they needed to know more about her. The biggest question on their minds, the poll found, was what her plans and policies would be. Samira Ali, a sophomore at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, entered the debate unsure whether she would vote at all. She left a raucous viewing party on campus, still unsure. Quote, she still has to impress me. As someone who recently moved into her own place off campus and she has to buy groceries for the first time, she said she wanted to hear Ms. Harris speak more about housing costs and inflation. I'm still deciding, she said. She's a college kid, 19 years old. And a woman. In Las Vegas, Gerald Mays, 40, said he felt both candidates failed to connect their campaign promises to his family's budget, and he came away confused. Nothing is clear to me, and I'm really trying to follow it. I want to know how all this impacts my family financially. You notice how they're not bringing up January 6th, and they're not bringing up all the other nonsense? They want to know how the candidates are going to help them economically. And the reason why Kamala Harris can't answer that question is because Kamala Harris can't help them economically. Bottom line, she can't. That's why there's no policy specifics. That's why there's no policy details. If there's another debate and Trump gets into specifics about policies, if he talks about how much better things were when he was president, if he does those things and beats her up badly on her progressive ideals on the economy, he will win handily. Handily. Kristen Morris, 60 years old, a nursing student from a suburb outside Charlotte, North Carolina, was deeply disappointed at the start of the summer with her presidential choices, but became intrigued when Ms. Harris entered the race. After the debate, she said she felt clear-eyed and planned to vote for the vice president. A longtime Republican who voted for Mr. Biden in 2020 and recently changed her affiliation to independent, Ms. Morris said, my expectations have been met. But others who have been unimpressed with their choices also found the debate clarifying, but in their doubts about Ms. Harris. Like Kalia Miller, 34 years old, who lives in Milwaukee, who was intrigued by Ms. Harris and says she voted Democrat in past elections but decided to stop voting altogether about a year ago. She's a black woman in Milwaukee, and she said her situation and that of other black women in Milwaukee has not improved. And on Tuesday, she felt nudged unexpectedly toward Mr. Trump. Trump's pitch was a little more convincing than hers. I guess I'm leaning more on his facts than her vision. Ms. Miller said that while her heart pulls her to Ms. Harris's potentially history-making candidacy, she finds herself thinking fondly of her old life. When Trump was in office, not going to lie, I was living way better, she said. I was living way better. I've never been so down as in the past 4 years. It's been so hard for me. Wow. See, now, if you're a Washington pundit and if you're an inside Washington guy, you can't understand that. You can't understand this point. You can't. But people watching who are really trying to figure out what to do, and these are not people wearing MAGA hats. And they want an excuse, they really do, to not vote for him. But they know deep down inside he's better. When Trump was in office, not going to lie, I was living way better. I've never been so down as in the past 4 years. It's been so hard for me, she said. In southern Arizona, Jason Henderson, a defense contractor and retired soldier, had been resigned to skipping the election, unable to stomach either candidate. Like Ms. Miller, though, he came away from the debate leaning tenuously toward Trump. Trump had more commanding presentation. There was nothing done by Harris that made me think she's better in any way. And this is a guy who voted for Obama, then voted for Trump. And he says he's allowed that Mr. Trump came off as crazy, but he was no different from his appearances at rallies and interviews. He said Mr. Trump successfully attacked Ms. Harris on the border and immigration. While the vice president gave better answers on abortion and race, he said she did not get into specifics about her tax plans for parents or small businesses. As he watched post-debate commentary on cable news, Mr. Henderson said he bristled at the pundits who widely panned Mr. Trump's performance. Had they watched the same debate, he wondered? Still, Mr. Henderson said his new enthusiasm might fade once the frenzy surrounding the debate passes. I'll probably come back to my senses, he said. I don't think so. I don't think so. And I think that the problem for Kamala Harris, and this is what I said to you on the show yesterday, she can't take a kill shot on Trump. Trump can bloody himself, but there's no way to kill him because the economy is still the number one issue. Her economic ideals are disastrous. Her economic ideas are disastrous. They're disastrous. Her record is disastrous. These things are facts, and facts are stubborn, as you know. This, by the way, is the top story of the day today, brought to you by my buddy, Dr. Mike Veneria, VeneriaDental.com. Go see him today for your perfect smile, VeneriaDental.com. So hopefully that gives you some hope as we continue along here in our fourth and final hour on Talk Radio 1210 WPHD. Don't go away.
The Rich Cioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHD.
So every year around 9/11, I always try to bring my dad on. He, of course, is Lieutenant Anthony Cioli of the Port Authority Police Department, also author of a book called, it's a true story about his recovery team, Romeo, and we'll let my dad talk about that a little bit. But here on the 20th anniversary of 9/11 for our Through the Eyes Remembrance Show today, I want to welcome him back. Dad, thanks for making time this morning. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you, Rich. Anytime I can, you know, continue telling the story of Ground Zero and especially my team, I just don't know what to say other than thank you.
Of course. Well, listen, there's a lot of emotions. There's a lot of I think probably competing emotions, too. Let me just ask you first and foremost. I mean, a lot of the guys that so Recovery Team Romeo is retired Port Authority police officers and other officers who got together to. Tell us the story.
Well, of course, after the attack on 9/11. Everybody, I mean, there was so many, probably thousands of police officers and fire department personnel from literally so many countries all around the world. I can remember working with emergency service cops from Puerto Rico, from Mexico, from Canada, from Great Britain. It was amazing. And then, of course, everybody from New York and New Jersey and the surrounding area, they came down as well. And everybody in the beginning was basically a volunteer. And except for the paid police departments like NYPD and the Port Authority PD and the New York City Fire Department. Of course, those guys were paid. Anyway, as the search, rescue, and recovery turned into basically a non-rescue because everybody who had been saved was already saved in the first couple of hours after the collapse. And it was apparent to Governor Pataki, who was the New York State governor at the time, and Mayor Giuliani, that all those that were rescued had been rescued, and now it was going to be a recovery mission. And they basically thank all the other departments from all over the world and all over our country, of course, for coming down. And they closed the 16-acre site of the former World Trade Center. And the only departments allowed to work there were the New York City Police Department, the New York City Fire Department, and the Port Authority Police Department of New York and New Jersey. And I should note that there were 343 firemen killed that day, and a total of 60 police officers, 23 from NYPD and 37 from the Port Authority. And that 37 number represented the greatest number of police officers killed in any single event, including terrorism, anywhere in the world at any time in the past. So it was a massive amount of guys. And at the time, New York City was an army. They had about 35 to 37,000 active police officers, whereas the Port Authority then had about 1,600 officers. Today, they're actually at about the 15th largest in the country with about 2,300 officers. But back then, 1,600. And so many of the command staff were killed in the attack itself, including the superintendent of police, an inspector, a couple of captains, lieutenants. So our department was basically shorthanded. So Joe Morris, who was an inspector at the time, was giving a battlefield promotion to chief of department. And he was short on guys, so he asked me, you know, I worked with Joe many times as an active lieutenant, if me and my guys would be willing to stay on for as long as it took to accomplish our mission. And we had a meeting, myself and the 11 other members of what has been known as Team Romeo, Romeo because of the R in retirement. And they all agreed, yeah, we'd stay on as long as needed. And then it came down to a matter where should we stay on as volunteers or go back on the clock. And actually, Governor Pataki had given Chief Joe Morris the power to be able to bring us back on to the department if we wanted to and be paid. And we decided we didn't want that because we didn't know how long it was going to go, and we figured we'd get back to our retirement lives as soon as possible. But as it turns out, the average member of Team Romeo did 2,000 hours of service, with a few guys doing a little bit more. I did 2,000 hours myself, and we stayed on from, the very beginning to actually the last day on May 30th, 2002. And we were such a great team, and we had such high respect by the other departments, NYPD and the fire department, that on the last day we were given the honor. If you recall, there was this great, great parade of recovery workers that came up that massive steel ramp from the terror and the hardship of Ground Zero and the attack to the streets of New York, and hopefully a new positive life for the city, the state, and our country. And we were given that honor of being the last recovery team up that ramp, which is something that, you know, we felt so honored. And we became so close with all the other departments, and as time goes by, we found a lot of those guys on both departments succumb to their Ground Zero related conditions and injuries. I don't know anybody that worked down there that does not have some sort of serious condition. Myself, I had 6 Ground Zero related surgeries, 2 cancers, 2 throat reconstructive surgeries, a sinus surgery, and a feeding tube, which was the most painful of everything. And I had, you know, one friend was so overwhelmed with PTSD that he actually took his own life by jumping off the George Washington Bridge. Another police officer was so overwhelmed with PTSD, and he never even worked his site, but he covered so many guys so they could work. And so many of his close friends were killed in the attack that he hung himself in his own basement. And then I had Barry Galfano. He was NYPD emergency service captain. We became very, very close friends. And I was with him the last week of his life when he succumbed to brain cancer. And that just goes on and on and on. And they keep finding out that there are more and more Ground Zero related conditions as the time and years go by. So anyway, that's where I stand so far. And this Saturday, your 20th anniversary, and as we have in the past, we'll have most of us go down to the site early in the morning, and then we'll meet for a memorial luncheon at the place we've been meeting for every Tuesday since 2002 when we started the 9/11 Cops Association. And this Tuesday coming will be our 940th consecutive meeting.
Which is remarkable.
So, yeah, it is.
And the support system that you have for each other. My dad is with me, Tony Zioli, retired police lieutenant, and the author of Rising from the Ashes, The True Story of 9/11 and Recovery Team Romeo. The support network that you guys have created for each other, and you've been gracious enough to invite me to some of those lunches. I mean, it really is remarkable because there's a lot of gallows humor. There's a lot of camaraderie across departments from all over. You welcome everybody, but there's also something very special about all the guys who were there at the pit together and the loss that you've all had to deal with and the trauma and the emotions of that. And I definitely think from my own, just watching you in the last 20 years, I think that it's been so essential to you to have that group of guys that really there were very few reasons you would ever miss one of your lunches.
Yeah, it's social, of course, but it's a therapy session as well. It really is, because guys talk about all kinds of things that affect their life. And somehow it always revolves around something to do with Ground Zero and the time spent searching for human bodies. And one of the things I always talk about is that when we were doing the recovery, you don't find human bodies the way you would like in a funeral parlor. If you found anything, it was certainly almost unrecognizable. And you would take it to the body remains, to the morgue, and have them hopefully DNA'd so we could bring them back to their family. And the way it was that if we found somebody in the first 30 days, we had a funeral. If we didn't find them, I'm talking about members of the department, and every department did this, in the first 30 days, if there was no recovery, we'd have a memorial for the guy. And then sometimes you found them after the 30 days, and then we'd have a funeral. And so we would be in the middle of, working down at the pit, doing our search and recovery. And then we'd get the word that they found somebody or we identified somebody. We'd come out and, covered with dirt and debris. And we'd all march into a bus or a couple of cars and we'd go to wherever this memorial would be. And as soon as that would be over, boom, right back to the pit and right back down to what we were doing. We felt that, it was our destiny to do this. And that's why nobody wanted money. Nobody wanted any kind of gratuity or trip or anything like that. We just did it because we had to do it. And so we talk about it all the time. If we want to, we don't have to. Guys can talk about anything they want. You sit there, over a couple of beers and a nice lunch and spend some time. Usually we spend several hours together. Like Saturday now, it'll be probably from 1 o'clock. Probably to in the early evening. And we expect probably, 75, 100 guys and women will show, police officers that worked or that helped us out. Other departments that never really went down there and did recovery, but they came down those first couple of weeks before beginning of October when it was turned into a recovery-only mission. And that's what I'll be doing this Saturday.
When you think about the fact that you worked in the World Trade Center, you were assigned as a police officer to the World Trade Center complex itself. And I know that, I mean, in the 90s, after the first attempted bombing of the World Trade Center, it was successful bombing, but obviously nothing to the grand spectacle of 9/11. But security was it was impenetrable. It was like a fortress after that.
Yeah, it was. I didn't spend that much time as a cop down there, but I was a sergeant when I first got promoted, and they sent me down there for about 6 months to get familiar with it. You know, you had to basically bounce around with a lot of their commands. And I did have a great respect for the cops that were assigned down there, because it was a different type of patrol. It wasn't as much crime and violence as it was helping people. And when the attack happened in February, who could believe it? That, you know, somebody would attack the World Trade Center. But then in 2001, on 9/11, who would believe that anybody could take down those towers, especially if they're failing in the previous attack? And all of a sudden now the towers are gone. And I can remember and never forget when I first got there and I looked at it, and to me it was like, it looked like the end of the world. It looked like the gates of hell, and that all the goodness in the world finally came to an end in one gigantic collapse of two buildings that represented the strength of the United States. And it was unbelievable. I never forget that first day I saw it. And I can't remember. I'll never forget the last day when they gave us the honor of being the last recovery team to walk up that steel ramp to a bright new future, hopefully.
Can you ever get the smell out of your mind?
You know, when you think about it, you can't. You can't get it out. And I have such vivid memories of certain things, recovery of police officers that I was involved with. And those are the things that I never forget. And those are the smells and visions that I wish I could forget, but I can never forget. And every so often we would get a thank you letter from somebody's family member who we recovered, and they were positively identified as being that person, and we'd get letters from them and they would thank us, and that was all we needed to keep us going. That was all we needed to keep going, because that's why we were there. We're doing God's work. We felt that we were, and like I tell everybody that. The proof of that there is a God, as crazy as this may sound, is that when the first plane hit at 8:46 in the morning, got to understand the World Trade Center had between 50 and 100,000 visitors every day to that complex from all over the world. And that all started at about 9 a.m. in the morning. If that first plane would have hit any time after 9 a.m., we wouldn't be talking about 2,700 plus people that passed away at the World Trade Center. So we'd be talking about tens of thousands. And the second thing I always point to, actually two other things I point to. This was one of the mildest winters in New York history. Not one police officer or firefighter lost his life or was seriously injured in the recovery effort because of the weather or the cold. And the third thing is the famous crucifix of steel with a white sheet that was found early on in the days, and we don't know how it got there. It was a perfect cross with a white sheet, and everybody stopped to pray there, and eventually it was moved, and I think it's right now it's in the 9/11 museum. But it gave us hope that God was with us, that, you know, he couldn't stop the attack, but he gave us the strength to go on and to recover as many people as we could. So.
Well, you take the hope and you take the faith from these things, and you have to. I mean, you really do. In the face of such evil, as you so well said, you stood in hell, you saw the evil firsthand, and so it's so important to take those signs, I think. And I appreciate you sharing the story with us again, Dad. I know every year I ask you to do it, and every year you do it. And I know that you do that on behalf of everybody who's not here today to tell their story.
Exactly true. It has to keep being told over and over again, and hopefully it'll never happen again, but we must tell it.
Well said. Well, please, as always, send my best to the guys. They are,
I certainly
are
will,
your family,
Rich.
As much as we are your family. Rising from the Ashes, The True Story of 9/11 and Recovery Team Romeo, written by my dad, and very proud of him, obviously, Lieutenant Anthony Zioli of the Port Authority Police Department. Dad, love you. Thank you. Hang in there.
Love you too,
because I know,
buddy,
it's going to be a tough weekend with a lot of emotions. So,
yeah, it will be. Thank you.
All right, Dad.
The Rich Zioli Show on Talk Radio 1210 WPHT.
I'm John Oran, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity. I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media. Available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.